joining us today. I wanted to start by saying good morning, good day, or good evening, depending on where you are across the globe. My name is Vincent Pickett, and I am thrilled to welcome you today to Fulbright's Impact in the Field panel. I'm the branch chief for the Fulbright office in the U.S. Department of State's Bureau on Educational and Cultural Affairs, and one part of my portfolio is directing the global communication strategy for the Fulbright program. And that role gives me exciting opportunities like moderating today's panel. So I'm very thankful that I get to do this. First of all, those of you who might not already be familiar with Fulbright, let me make a couple comments about the program, which has supported about 400,000 Fulbrighters over almost 75 years of existence. Fulbright is led by the U.S. Department of State and the United States government in partnership with more than 160 countries worldwide. It offers international educational and cultural exchange programs for students, scholars, artists, teachers, and professionals of all backgrounds, including public health professionals, to do a number of things overseas, including studying, teaching, carrying out research, and professional projects. Fulbright offers Americans a chance to go abroad and non-U.S. citizens to come to the United States. And Fulbright's primary source of funding is an annual appropriation by the U.S. Congress to the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. And it also receives direct or indirect support from participating governments through Fulbright commissions, from host institutions, foundations, and the private sector. So with all that, anyone who's inspired by the panel today, I wanted to mention that Fulbright is accepting applications for the 2021-22 academic year. Go ahead and apply if you're moved to do so. Fulbrighters are leaders who are making an impact. Everyone on the planet has been affected in some way by the coronavirus global pandemic. Since the emergence of COVID-19, Fulbrighters have been working tirelessly to find innovative ways to help their communities and find solutions to local and global public health challenges. Many Fulbrighters and Fulbright alumni are using skills gained during their Fulbright experience in their current roles at the forefront of the fight against COVID-19. We're all very grateful for this group of U.S. and foreign alumni who have agreed to share their experience today and their expertise with us as part of our first Fulbright in the Field panel. Today, our panel consists of a group of scientists, physicians, and public health experts who are joining us from around the world to discuss COVID-19 and the current challenges in public health that we're all facing. The panelists who will speak today represent a small cross-section of Fulbrighters who are working to combat COVID-19. Now, we know there are many other important voices, nurses, first responders, teachers, and more, who, while not being on the panel today, deserve recognition and thanks for the work that they're doing. So I thank all of them on behalf of the department and the Fulbright program. If you're a Fulbright alum who wants to share your story, or you know a Fulbrighter who has a story that people should hear, please do let us know. You can type something into the chat, and we'll handle it from there. This is the first Fulbright Impact in the Field panel. We'll be doing more, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. And we're looking forward to highlighting other voices and discussing other topics on future panels. So let's get started by meeting our panels. Serena Deshani was a Fulbright ETA to Indonesia in 2013 and is currently a frontline physician at Penn Medicine in Philadelphia. She'll share a perspective as a primary care physician treating COVID patients and working to improve healthcare administration. And she told me that if she disappears, it's not because she's not interested in the panel, it's because she actually may be called to do a little bit of work on the floor. Javier Jaimez was a foreign Fulbright student from Columbia at Cornell University in 2014. Now he's a virologist working in research and education, currently studying the pathogenesis of the virus behind COVID-19. Welcome. Igor Stoma was a visiting scholar from Belarus at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City in 2017-2018, and he's currently a clinical professor at Belarusian State Medical University with research interests in emerging infectious diseases. He's also an infectious disease attending physician who consults on the treatment of the most complex cases of COVID-19. Thanks for taking your time out to join us today. Charlotte Summers was a Fulbright visiting scholar from the UK to the University of California, San Francisco in 2013, and is now an academic critical care physician at Cambridge in the UK. where she's translating basic science into therapies for critical ill patients. Thanks for coming. Benjamin Tinover was a U.S. scholar at the Institut Pasteur École Normale Supérieure in France in 2014 and is director of the Virus Engineering Center for Therapeutics and Research for Vector at Mount Sinai. He's involved in an international consortium to develop vaccines and antivirals against the coronavirus. And finally, Imre Waryu was a Fulbright visiting scholar from Hungary to Boston Children's Hospital at Harvard Medical School in 2016. And he currently serves as a medical scientist and health communication specialist. He's currently working as a health education and behavior change strategist, focusing on behavioral aspects of the pandemic, as well as how the risk is being communicated and understood by the public. So, it's an impressive panel that we have in front of us. I'm very excited to get to the questions. I wanted to thank them first publicly for taking the time to join us today. And let's get started with a general question for all of you to answer. So we're all adjusting to the new normal of quarantine, social distancing, and connecting through screens, sometimes even successfully, while essential workers on the front lines are heroically carrying out their work. For us, it is challenging, however, in the field, however challenging it is for us in the field, this challenge must manifest itself in different ways. Could you please explain what you're currently working on and share how your typical workday has changed in this new environment? I think our audience would also be interested in your observations about the virus and about daily life during the pandemic. So I'm going to open this up to all the different panelists. I'm going to start with Benjamin.
Well, hello everybody. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation to share, I guess, our experiences and thoughts here in New York. So I run a lab that studies viruses and how the host responds to viruses. And so as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, my whole lab switched over from studying influenza, chikungunya, dengue virus to studying exclusively SARS-CoV-2. And as you mentioned, we're part of a large consortium that includes my former Fulbright partner in crime, Marco Vignuzzi at the Pasteur Institute, as well as people really from all over the world. So the lab not only has changed topic, but we have been definitely working in increased hours. So I would say we are putting in 120 hours a week. Everybody is. We are all working on one common goal, which is quite unique for an academic lab to do. And we, instead of just looking purely at academics and learning the nuts and bolts of how the molecular biology of a virus and host might interact with each other, we're also now doing much more direct clinical work, like testing stockpiles of FDA-approved drugs in different animal models to see if we can demonstrate efficacy against SARS-CoV-2, and testing vaccines, which is a little out of our wheelhouse, but we've adapted quickly to try and contribute in the best way we can.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much for sharing. I'm going to move over to Serena now, please.
Yeah, so from a clinical perspective, I would say that we're continuously developing new protocols in the ICU. So because all the information is evolving and we're gaining new insights about different therapeutics and diagnostics that can help us optimize patients' outcomes, everything is quickly changing, which requires frequent meetings with our entire department and a centralized way for us to communicate new insights to each other, which we've been doing through live documents and designating specific individuals within our residency program and our department to take on those initiatives. Also, we've kind of been seeing that while the COVID numbers in Philadelphia are starting to plateau, the patients that would come to the hospital who have other medical problems are actually coming in much sicker because our numbers during the COVID surge for non-COVID patients actually went down, and our hypothesis is that these patients may not have been coming to the hospital because they were avoiding the hospital in the setting of COVID, and now they're coming in much more critical states. So we've had to basically increase the support from both the house staff and the attendings in the ICU to kind of manage the new acuity in these patients. And then From a research perspective, I also do healthcare systems research, and I try to answer questions about what are different financial implications involved in our healthcare system. And so one of the questions we're working on answering right now is, how have the cancellation of elective surgeries impacted academic medical centers' revenue and forecasted profits for this quarter?
That's great. Thank you very much for sharing as well. Seems like this is very nice, because I'm excited about this panel because we all have very different perspectives on what's going on. So I'm excited to hear the next perspective, which I'm going to ask Javier to speak to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for having us here today. I'm also a scientist. I work in a lab when we studied how viruses infect cells. Basically, we were studying coronaviruses for the last probably like 12 years. And well, once we knew that there was a new coronavirus coming out from the field, we decided to actually switch all our work to work in this new virus. So as many other people, we have been working here like extra hours. We are a pretty small lab, but we are still like doing a lot of work, and we have to kind of like clone ourselves to be able to actually meet all the expectations that we have now for all the studies that we are doing. We are basically studying how this virus, how is the pathogenesis, how the virus actually infects the cells, and we are also testing several compounds at the cell culture level to see if those are like potential effects inhibiting or actually diminishing the viral replication. As many other people, my life has changed a lot. Also, I decided to explore different areas during this pandemic, and I decided to go to do a little bit of science communication during these days. And this has been a really nice opportunity to try to reach people, non-scientists, to try to bring them some like scientific ideas and real facts about what is happening outside and what is happening in our labs.
Thank you, Javier. And I think you're bringing up something that we're very excited about as well, which is we do have a lot of people who have joined us today on the webinar who are non-scientists, including your humble moderator. So anything that you guys can do to make sure that your messages are spoken, you know, to people who I'm sure are very intelligent but maybe not as scientifically inclined as you all, it's really great. We really need scientists who can speak to the public. So thanks for the work that you're doing. I'm going to send it over to the UK and ask Charlotte to comment.
Hi, and thank you so much for asking me to be part of this webinar. So like Simina, I am a critical care physician. I'm an academic critical care physician, and so that means life has been slightly turned upside down in that I've been doing more clinical service than I would do normally, and more kind of bedside and clinical management focused activity. But on the academic side, I've long been a lung injury and ARDS researcher. So actually what's happened is that we've got a large number of patients with acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS all at the same time. So if you're an ARDS researcher, it's kind of your field has exploded suddenly, and there's large numbers of patients for you to study for research. So my actual field of research has not really changed, but there's an enormous amount more to do than there was kind of even at the beginning of January. And so what my lab have been focusing on is understanding the way in which the immune response of the host to COVID happens, but also looking at how we can find treatments that might work. So we've been very, very involved in a lot of the early phase two clinical trials and designing those and looking at what therapies should go into those. There's a national platform phase two trial in the UK, which I'm on the steering committee group for. So I spent a lot of hours working on that to try and find a cure as fast as possible via a therapeutic rather than a vaccine approach.
Well, thank you, Charlotte. Thank you for that and the important work that you're doing in the UK. And I'm going to ask for a final comment on this to be from Imre.
Yes, hi everyone, and thanks so much for organizing this, and thank you so much for having us. And this is a wonderful opportunity to be amongst really wonderful people who are working on this project tirelessly and on this healthcare issue tirelessly. I'm trained as a medical scientist, and my Fulbright scholarship was to Harvard Medical School was around the intersection of immunity and thrombosis, a very common form of cardiovascular disease. So what's happening right now and all the side effects and all the implications of how COVID is starting to pan out is of deep interest to me. However, nowadays I'm not working anymore in the science field. I'm working as a health education and behavior change strategist. So the agency I work with, we support many patient support programs from the patient side and also on the healthcare professional side. So obviously the COVID situation has increased the number of challenges that we're facing immensely, and we need to think about how to best support patients day and night given this new situation. That is my day-to-day job, but obviously before that, before I start work, with a few hours after I wake up and before I actually go to work online, and also the few hours before I fall asleep, after I finish work, I continuously think about how I can use my health communication and science communication expertise and how to understand the public reaction to actually the COVID outbreak and I'm very interested in seeing how the public is reacting from a behavioral science angle and what is that we science communicators can do to make the public better understand the risk.
Thank you for that. And I want to pick up on something that you just brought up. You brought up your Fulbright experience, which is really fantastic. It's a nice segue into my next question. I did want to ask you guys about the importance of international collaboration in science and in public health, broadly, but also as Fulbrighters, you've all had these international connections and experiences while on your Fulbright. I wanted to know, beyond the general question, is what role has Fulbright played in your current work or your experience with Fulbright? Oh, you know what? I did skip Igor. So I don't know if you would like to jump right back in and go, and then we can go back to my question. We're all sort of learning the new technology of these type of meetings, so I apologize. But
no,
I do have Kate, who jumped on and quickly told me that I should not be asking my next question yet.
Okay, great. Thank you, Vincent. Hello, everybody. It's a great honor for me to be among you. Thank you very much for inviting me. So I'm infectious disease physician, and during these hard times, I would like to say that everybody, including you, have become ID physicians right now. So like 1 or 2 years ago, only we as ID physicians were dealing with unknown infectious diseases, and now everybody deal because we still do not know a lot about COVID-19, unfortunately. So what concerns my typical workday as attending ID physician, I do the clinical rounds at the infectious hospitals. So we have large infectious hospitals where we try together all the complicated cases, and including the cases where patients have numerous negative PCRs. So by the fact that they have negative PCRs twice or three times, we may say that there's no COVID-19, but still clinically they have COVID-19, and we treat them as COVID-19 patients right now. And as a physician, one of the interesting things that I would like to mention, from the start, we were prepared for the contagiousness, but we believed it would be much lower than we really had during these times. The contagiousness of this virus is really, really high. And other things that we mentioned, and I would like to say, the non-pulmonary manifestations. That's very strange when you expect to have a typical symptoms of respiratory virus, but you have non-pulmonary syndromes of damage of different organs. And the other thing that I would like to underline, as ID physicians, I treat a lot of hepatitis C patients. And we know that sometimes hepatitis C is called a silent killer. But concerning the COVID-19, today we start to call COVID-19 a silent killer because we see a numbers of patients that have very low oxygen in their blood, low saturation, and still they act well. They do not feel it. So they have saturation of 90, 91, 89, and they stay at home and feel themselves okay. So that's a problem that we may lose these complicated patients not checking them at home. Concerning the Fulbright story, I have been a visiting scholar at MSK at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and still every week we have a phone call, we have a telemedicine calling to Chicago, to New York, to discuss opportunities of treatment of COVID-19, because even now we have really a lot of questions, more questions than answers on how to treat severe patients with COVID-19. That's, I believe, one of the best Fulbright experience we have, is the possibility to use this collaboration to improve the patient's outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you for that, and again, apologies for skipping you, but I'm going to go right back to you with my next question, so I do not make that mistake again. My question basically was how has your Fulbright experience sort of set you up in this world of international collaboration in science and public health? And then more broadly, can you speak a little bit about the general collaboration in the world?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Vincent. So concerning the Fulbright collaboration, I've been doing gut microbiome studies in New York. And from the point of view of microbiome, I believe that virome, which is a part of the larger part of microbiome, is also a very interesting story to discuss within the COVID-19. I believe in the future, and there are some studies already going on how to affect the pandemic with manipulating microbiome and importantly the virome of the patient. And still all of us that are doing the biomedical science, we are strictly connected with clinical medicine. So anyway, if you do theoretical medicine, if you do practical medicine, you do a lot of good things for the COVID-19 right now. So I think that's one of the best experiences in my life.
Thanks for that. Let's see. Benjamin, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, sure. So Fulbright plays a very unique experience in my world anyways, in that I went as both to, as a teacher to, at the UNS, as you mentioned, but then I embedded myself into Marco Vignuzzi's lab, almost as a sabbatical for me. Being part of the Pasteur, it became very clear that our alignments in the microbiology department at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai are very much in line with that at Pasteur. And Pasteur has this international network of institutes all around the world, but lack one in the U.S. And so upon returning from my Fulbright, we actually turned Mount Sinai into the first U.S. satellite for Pasteur's program. And as a result of that, we were able to very quickly enable the research on SARS-CoV-2 because we could get novel strains that were isolated from all over the world very early on. We can coordinate our efforts because they also have a high containment facility, so research with this virus demands something referred to as a biosafety level 3 facility, which is like a pressurized room with many, many different precautions and spacesuits and the like to keep our researchers safe. And we could coordinate our efforts at that level as well so that we didn't overlap efforts and you could do things in a complementary fashion. And so I would argue that without the Fulbright, there would definitely be a lack of relations between the U.S. and the French science virologists in this respect. So I think it's done wonders to bring us together.
Thanks for that. And I'm going to ask Serena now to comment because you did not go on a medical program or a focused program on public health for Fulbright, but you did something quite different.
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to teach lovely students in Indonesia, and I think I actually did that before I went to medical school, but my experience taught me just really fundamental skills and learning about my community, learning about the people who I'm trying to help and I'm trying to teach, and recognizing that, you know, teaching and medicine, as both a teacher and a doctor, you're a lifelong learner, and you can learn just as much from your students and your patients as you can teach them. So I think the fundamental principles that drive my care for my patients here in the hospital were definitely kind of all formed and were instilled in me when I was in Indonesia.
Thanks for that. That's really great to hear. I do love these stories of people who go out and do, you know, one thing as in their Fulbright year, and then they come back and they really make an impact in a different field. So I think it's, you know, it's quite a wonderful story to hear. So let's see, Javier, would you like to comment?
Yeah, sure. Well, to me, the Fulbright experience hasn't over yet because I'm still here in U.S. I came to do my PhD like 6 years ago, and I decided to stay to do some more research. When I was in Colombia, I was doing a completely different thing. I was doing more like translational science. I was doing more like diagnostics, and then I switched here to a completely new field that taught me a lot of like new experience, new skills that I'm actually now applying to health people in my country. So during this pandemic, I have been able to actually collaborate with a lot of people in my country to provide them materials, provide them advising help during the whole setting up of techniques and during the all the epidemiological meetings and everything they had there. I have been able to actually participate in that way. And as I mentioned before, staying here gave me the tools to actually reach even more people. And when I decided to do science communication, I decided to try to reach a higher community, not only the Colombian community, and actually I've been able to actually touch people, Spanish-speaking people all around the world. I have been able to participate to it and in meetings and interviews and talk to people in Europe, in Latin America, and South America, and here in U.S. So it's been a huge whole experience that was not only the scientific part, but was also all the cultural change and all the magnificent tools that I got from all this Fulbright opportunity.
That's really great as well. Thank you very much for sharing. Unfortunately, I don't think we've got a whole list of questions here, and I don't know if it's a good idea to ask everyone to comment on every single one. So if any of the rest of you who haven't spoken have a burning desire to jump in and talk about this, please let me know. And if not, we'll move on to the next question. Okay, that's great. So this is a little bit more, we're moving a little bit away from the Fulbright specific experience and moving on to some of the COVID-19 early lessons that you guys are learning. We're wondering about some of the early lessons that you're learning about COVID-19 and more generally, some of the best practices for managing large-scale public health issues. And I wanted to start with Charlotte.
So I think what COVID-19 to me has brought into really clear focus is that the most important thing about managing is communication and communication at scale to both people within geographical boundaries in kind of counties or regions or countries, but also internationally, because it's a global health problem and requires a global solution. So it requires collaboration across those boundaries, and we have to talk about that, but also the solutions and the temporizing measures about how we all cope and the lessons that we learned need to be shared, and things like lockdown, which have happened in the UK and in a whole host of other countries, actually sharing those experiences and learning what works and what doesn't, communication and the way in which we do that by things like this, and learning new techniques for that, I think has been the single biggest change for me. I'm not sure we're there yet, and it's very much a work in progress, but it's been a really pleasing aspect of something that's been pretty traumatic for a lot of people.
That's great. Serena, do you have something to add?
Yeah, so I couldn't agree more. I think communication is the absolutely most important thing, and I just want to touch on the component of how important it's been for us in the ICU to communicate with the families as frequently as possible, multiple times a day. Many of them can't come to the hospital because of precautions that have been put in place, and it's just been really wonderful to see how collaborative our nursing staff and everyone supporting us in the ICU has been with making sure that we're touching base with families every day, trying to explain to them what we do know, what we don't know, and try to kind of alleviate any sort of concerns or fears that we have despite the huge amounts of uncertainty. And then something else I wanted to mention is I think it's been really important as a physician to just stay tenacious, commit to this journey of lifelong learning of medicine, keep our eyes, our ears wide open, listening to what sorts of insights everyone's developing across the world. And then also to just be flexible and be humble. So although, someone might know exactly how to improve the oxygenation into someone who has, a known disease, this is a disease we're constantly learning about. So while we might not know what's evolving for these patients, it's important for us to just be humble and to take insights from every single person who's caring for the patient.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I think in addition to, as the conversation kind of moves in a little bit of a way towards communications, Imre, I think that you've been involved in that as well. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is one of the main one of my main focuses right now is how do people understand the risk and how do people respond to the way the risk is being communicated to them? And this leads us to many, many, many different questions. And I think there are a couple of emerging themes, and one of the themes that is absolutely of essence is to understand that there's not only an epidemic, but there's also a misinfodemic at the same time, or an infodemic, as coined by the WHO, which means that misinformation also spreads at a really, really high speed. And the platforms that misinformation finds for itself are almost more efficient than those platforms that official authorities use to communicate with the people. So there needs to be lots and lots of caution when for the general public when they meet any sort of information, and how to dissect misinformation from actual credible information is a major challenge right now. There is also an underlying issue which is not new, not specific to the U.S., but more like it's a global issue, is that the general health literacy levels of people is not, so let's say it's not where it should be right now. About every third American has sort of below only sufficient or only sufficient health literacy levels. And when we talk about health literacy, we talk about the ability of people to understand and act upon health-related information that they receive. And this is a global phenomenon, and we're just globally not doing well enough on educating people about health issues and increasing their overall health literacy levels. So these two things meet in the current pandemic. And the third component is also that the way authorities communicate with the general public is sometimes really hard to grasp and really hard to understand, and the concepts that are being communicated are really hard to understand. So this overall creates a mixture of chaos, and in this kind of stirred up environment, people really don't know where to look for credible information and how to proceed.
Yeah, thank you for that. Now, I wanted to follow up with you on just one piece as well. If we as the general public are looking for, you know, the easiest, most, you know, credible information that we can understand, you know, where do we go to find that? Where are some of the places to get the best reputable information that's clear that people would actually understand?
Yeah, this is more challenging than ever, I would say. It seems like an easy question, and it's a very important question, but it's also hard to answer. And I'm sure that Javier has you know, thoughts on this also. But what I would like to highlight is that maybe tweaking the question in a way to how do we equip people to spot misinformation is just as big as issue as how do we direct them to the right information. In terms of where to look for credible information, I always suggest that people turn to health authorities such as the WHO, or if it's country specific, it can be the CDC. And you know, every single country has their own authorities where these scientific data are communicated real time, and that is the most credible source people can go to. However, the path that people take there is flooded with misinformation. It's very, very unlikely that if someone searches for something COVID-related, they're not going to bump into a huge crowd of misinformation. And so people really need to kind of be equipped with a new skill, which is how to spot this misinformation and how to dismantle it. And it's incredibly hard because people are generally not scientists, and it's not expected that people will do that generally. However, we really need to exercise caution nowadays because, as I said, misinformation spreads very fast. And if we don't spot it, and if we accidentally share something that creates this kind of misled sense of comfort in a treatment that might help or a prevention method that might help, when at the same time it's not scientifically credible and it's not recommended, then what we're actually spreading is we're spreading complacency, and we're spreading this notion that the situation is not that serious and that there are solutions out there which are super easy, when in reality that's not the case. So how do we spot this misinformation? There are many tools online that help us do that. There are fact checker sites as well. And also, I just generally would caution everyone, whenever someone sees something that seems too good to be true, just always think twice before we forward something or share something. And how do we know if that's the case? Well, is the title very flashy? Is the title about something like an extra sensational new kind of finding that scientists just put together? Always exercise caution when that's the headline. Always read above the headline and see what's in the text. Always look for sources. This is something we generally don't do, but now we have to learn to always look for sources, always cite back the piece of information that always track back the piece of information that we're getting to some sort of credible source. If such credible source does not exist, then it's very likely that we're facing a hoax. Also, who wrote the article? Who wrote the piece that we're facing? Is there an author at all? And I could go on and on and on, but what I would like to emphasize is that scrutiny when we're facing any sort of new information in this era is of essential importance. And if there's really no more tools in our toolbox, I would generally recommend, at least I recommend in my professional network, is just to turn to a professional and ask questions. And professionals nowadays are overwhelmed. They probably have little time, but still, that is the best thing that we can do. If there's an information that we cannot decide if it's correct or not, just turn to the professional that is closest to you and ask about their input. I myself dismantle misinformation on a daily basis, and in a way, I'm very disappointed that I have to do this, but at the same time, I think that it's really, really crucial that we do this, because that's how complacency and misinformation spreads.
I completely agree. Thank you for doing that important work. And we actually work a lot at the State Department on disinformation, on a daily basis as well. And it is a real, difficult thing to combat. And I wonder, Javier, did you have something to add?
Yeah, sure. There's a question that I was asked a while ago about, like, what was the difference between the pandemics in 2000, the epidemics actually in 2003, 2002 with SARS and the one that we are like facing now. And I feel that one of the main differences is that we are now in a world of like information and misinformation. We are now in a world with internet, access to social networks. And those are actually sources for spreading something that could be even more contagious than the actual virus, that is the misinformation. That's one of the most difficult challenges that we are facing now. And in my case, I've realized that people sometimes is not willing to take the time to read like two or three minute reading articles, but they're maybe willing to listen to you to talk for about 10 minutes. So that's what I've been doing, like just sitting down and just trying to put that information in terms that people can understand it. And maybe like trying to actually like break this, all these bad ideas that are going around, all this misinformation, all these like conspiracy theories that are around this pandemic. I've been trying to do that because that's one of the biggest challenges that we are facing now. And that will translate sometimes in like consequences, like people like following the wrong directions, like trying the wrong treatments, like doing things that you will never imagine that will happen before. But now, since you can put a video or you can put an article, and even if it's fake, even if it's just like an hour online, that will be enough to reach hundreds of thousands of people, and that will be enough to make people to make bad decisions. And that's one of the like probably the most difficult challenges that we are facing right now.
Yeah, thank you for following up on that as well. We are going to shift gears to a question about the response from frontline healthcare providers. What sort of changes are healthcare providers making in response to the pandemic in order to manage the influx of coronavirus patients or, the new reality of how hospitals and emergency rooms have been forced to change in order to prevent the further spread of the virus? I think, and I'm going to start, I think, with Serena.
Yeah, so I think you can think about this question from multiple different perspectives, both from how do you appropriately staff different units, how do you think about resources and protecting healthcare workers and staff in the hospital, and how do you think about like the overall wellness and well-being of staff. So just to go in like a stepwise order, when we think about staffing, we want to ensure that we have a method in place to evaluate objective data such that we're staffing our units appropriately. So the chairs of our critical care department, infectious disease department, and medicine all came together and came up with a 5-tier surge plan that was shared with all the advanced practitioners, the nurses, the respiratory therapists, and the residents, so that we know at what point of surge we're activated and what's coming up next and where would we be moving next, because our schedules are so atypical from our normal rotations. And I think just being like at having transparency into that plan allows and enables healthcare workers to be more flexible and to keep an open mind and to be open to just moving services and going where the need is. We've also, because we've had, you know, to cancel so many elective surgeries, we've also thought about ways to repurpose surgery residents and surgery attendings to have them help out in the ICU with lines and different procedures because if the critical care staff is dealing with other sorts of management decisions. And then I think from a resource level, we've increased our utilization of video monitoring of patients, so we're fortunate to have video capabilities in all of our ICU rooms, so we're able to, you know, look at the patient's ventilator, we're able to look at the patient themselves, so we're able to look at the patient's continuous monitoring from a video, which it allows us for that close observation without necessarily having to go into the room and look at the machines ourselves. And then also we've kind of all consolidated resources of if we do need additional PPE, what are specific organizations such as the Getus PPE Initiative, the Project 95, these are all resources that we've brainstormed together in case of emergency that we know where to go to next. And then just finally, from a wellness perspective, the residents have coordinated local efforts with some nonprofits that have popped up in the setting of this pandemic, such as there's one called Off Their Plate Here, there's another one called Feel the Fight, and they are basically seeking donations from various people who are willing to donate money to then use that money to pay local restaurants to then serve food in the hospital. So that's kind of been a nice way for us to ensure that we're also helping support local businesses and restaurants in our community, and also kind of helping increase the spirits of house staff and other staff in the hospital.
Well, that's really nice. It's really nice to hear that last part as well. I know that we all we're all doing what we can to sort of support our own communities, and it's so nice to hear that, people that are working incredibly hard, who I think a lot of us are thinking are the people we should be supporting, are also sort of paying it forward and supporting others in the community as well. It's really very uplifting. Charlotte, could you comment as well, please?
So very similar to Serena, the way in which we've coped with the pandemic is that we've redesigned and retasked the entire hospital from top to bottom. So everything has been adjusted so that we can look after well the patients who have coronavirus infection, the patients who might have coronavirus infection, and those that definitely don't. And so we can provide clinical services throughout for all of those groups of people, because obviously the usual work and the people who are getting sick from non-coronavirus infection related causes are still there and still need access to healthcare. In terms of from the ICU point of view, which is where I've mainly been involved, I was the person who wrote the surge plan for the hospital in which I work. So it involved working out how we were going to quadruple our ICU capacity should it be required, working out how we could staff that, where we could get all the kit from, everything about it, and with a tremendous team. But it's not a small undertaking to do that in a matter of weeks. We delivered successfully and not needed to actually go above 3 times our capacity, so we've been very fortunate. The other difference, I think, between Serena's experiences and mine are that I'm part of a national health service rather than particular institutions that aren't joined up. So the other way in which we've coped in the UK is we've had load leveling across hospitals in particular regions and networks of the country. So the National Health Service is divided up into regions. And so when the ICUs at hospitals kind of 100 miles away from us were struggling, we would transfer their patients and take those so that nobody got too much burden and not be able to cope. So there's been both regional and even super-regional load levelling and redesigns of service and networks and how all those things would work that we didn't have working effectively beforehand, but we do now. And similarly, we've had surgeons helping in the ICU that wouldn't normally be on our staff. We've had nurses and operating department technicians, again, who wouldn't normally be in ICU, a whole range of staff repurposed to come and join us that's required training, support for experiencing things that they would never have seen before. And psychological wellness has been a big theme for us. We're fortunate that we have a clinical psychologist on the staff at our ICU all the time for that kind of provision and psychological well-being sessions. And long-term support is something that we're really focused on at the moment.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. And Igor, I was hoping we could get a view from Belarus.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Concerning the story about how it changed, I would really like to emphasize how I feel the community efforts have changed the medicine. So I see numbers of people from community who help doctors, have physicians, hospital care with precautions, measures, even food. I would like just to show an example of one of the restaurants near infectious hospitals in Minsk, which stopped its service and started to work full-time to provide food for all the doctors in nearby hospitals who serve the patients in this area. So I believe that help of volunteers, help of community is very important, and it shows how healthcare and community work together. So, and it's very important, especially in the areas, for example, of poverty. Already there are messages that the incidence of COVID-19 is higher in crowded areas, in the overcrowded, in slums, for example. There were messages from Mumbai already about higher incidence. And I believe that especially in this communities, it is important to link healthcare professionals and community workers. Linking to the message that Imre said, it is very important in any communities to prevent rumors, to provide the accurate message on current situation. And one of the examples that we have made with our colleagues, with ID physicians and with software developers, we developed a website on COVID-19, a Russian-speaking website that provided up-to-date questions and answers for everybody from Russian-speaking part of the world. Wanted to ask infectious disease physicians on very, very different questions concerning themselves, their relatives, etc., etc. So I would like to say that this situation here with COVID-19, it's not only medical. In a large scale, it's also a position when we check how the society, how the community communicates with healthcare. In some places, it goes well, in some not, but we try to make it better.
All right, well, and there's a lot that you guys are doing, and it seems, a lot that a lot of people who are working, against COVID are doing for this, against the disease, and trying to find a cure and things like that. I was hoping to get Benjamin to make a little bit of a comment about some of the work that he's doing as part of Vector.
Yeah, sure, I'm happy to. I think many scientists kind of view this as a two-problem system that we need to solve. The first, obviously, being vaccines for development. And the truth is that the early data on vaccine development looks really promising. It doesn't look like this. It seems that the vast majority of kind of cookie-cutter vaccine strategies are very effective at causing high titers of antibodies that would protect an individual. And so really we just need to get through the safety testing, which hopefully will happen, by the end of this year, early next year, and in that kind of time frame. And so I find that very promising, and I think the research looks really good in that regard.
However, in the meantime, we also need to provide drugs that might work as prophylactics for healthcare workers, for the people who don't want to take vaccines or who you may be suspicious of these vaccines that have been developed in record speed. And the best way to do that is to look for the repurposing of FDA-approved drugs. So these are drugs that have already gone through the system and have already been proven to be safe in humans. We know a lot about their toxicity, how much you can take in a safe manner. And so the Department of Defense largely has supported very large efforts of which vector is involved in, where we, not so much my lab, so other labs screen through high-throughput screening. So they take huge collections of these FDA-approved drugs, and they test them on cells, very much like Javier was referring to. In fact, he might be involved in such a screen. And then those that perform well in those screens, which are really like cells grown on plastic, those get sent to my lab as well as other labs really all around the world that have biosafety level 3 facilities with animals that you can test out those drugs to ensure that, you know, just because they work in a plastic dish on cells does not mean, in fact, it rarely means that they're going to work in people. And so we need animal models to determine what is an effective way to treat, what is an effective administrative dose to actually get what would equate to an off-target effect. And so those efforts are going in full force right now in the hopes that we can find something that can be immediately deployable while we wait for our vaccine safety trials to finish.
It's very excellent to hear. And I'm thinking everyone is obviously sitting around waiting for, a cure or, an antibody or something to fix this. And I like some of the messages that came out earlier about the fact that, this is actually going to take quite a bit of work and time and trial and error, and everyone's very focused on making sure that it happens. But in the interim, in the time that we have right now, if I'm a normal person who's coping in my own way with dealing with the lives that we live now, COVID-19, where you're supposed to be doing social distancing and wearing a mask and all these type of things, I was hoping that I could get each of you guys to maybe provide our audience here with a few tips, or maybe one tip each, on something that they could be doing right now to make the world a little bit safer place and make sure that our public health professionals aren't, dealing with as many people as they seem to be dealing with now. So what can individuals do to kind of help?
Maybe I can go first. I guess the main thing that I would say is, if you have had coronavirus infection, please go and donate your convalescent plasma, so some blood, so that the serum from you can be used to treat other people. It's probably the single most effective therapy that we're going to get fast, and there's trials happening both in the UK, in Europe, and the US using convalescent plasma. So if you individually want to do one thing to help save somebody else's life, go and donate your blood.
That's great. Thank you, Charlotte. What about Javier?
Okay, well, I'm actually going to say two things that I would like people to understand. The first one is that I really hope that after this thing is over, because it's going to be over, people understand that we need to change our way to live, and we need to change many things that we are doing now wrong, like interacting with the nature, interacting with environment. We definitely need to change so many cultural things that are actually contributing to this kind of like epidemics and pandemics to happen. So that's one thing that I would like people to get, not for now, but for the future. And for now, I actually been trying to do a lot of like effort in trying to communicate something else, because my education is as a veterinarian, I'm a vet, and that's something that I want to tell people, that because there's a lot of information and misinformation about role of animals and the virus and transmissions, just to try to understand that pets are actually members of our families, and they must be treated as members of this family. It might be treated like that. So it means that whenever you're sick, whenever you are not feeling well, not only for the coronavirus, for any other disease, you should actually take care of your animals as a family member. You should try to isolate from them, and you try to avoid the risk of actually transmitting whatever virus or pathogen that you have to those animals, because they are also in risk. and they are not the cause of the problem. They are only a new kind of victim of this whole pandemic that we are living now.
This is why I asked open-ended questions, because I didn't see you going to talk about pets, but I think that's a very important thing that people aren't thinking about, especially in, you know, in my neighborhood where I see people all the time walking their pets. Thank you for that. Let's see, Igor, would you like to go next?
Yeah, thank you. I would like to start with very basic things for everybody. First, social distances, wash your hands, stay at home, and if you are a convalescent, I agree with Charlotte, that's definitely, and we had a nice experience in our hospitals with reconvalescent plasma donors, with some patients getting better. Still, the numbers are not really serious to make it a serious decision, but I would definitely recommend for reconvalescents to go and to help somebody, because it's one of the best things you can do today. From the other hand, I would like to say that the world will not be the same after pandemic, after COVID-19, and it will not be the same from the point of view of healthcare. We have to change a lot of things in the healthcare system, and a lot of decisions will be made based on the number of beds, because in some countries the number of hospitals were optimized. We call it optimized when you make it lower. But actually, we understood that this optimization, it made it worse. Because a few years ago, optimization was, let's get rid of some hospitals, of some beds, of some ICU beds, for example. They're very expensive. We don't need them. We do a lot of outpatient work right now. But now we see that inpatient system is very important. ICUs are very important. The attitude to medicine, the attitude of society to medicine is very important. And in the post-Soviet part of the world, we still have the system of the infectious disease hospitals. So it's a monoprofile hospital with 200, 250 beds strictly dedicated to infectious diseases. In this part of the world, we still have a high number of trained epidemiologists who are in charge of making the epidemiology story and trying to catch all the contacts from the first to the second level. So maybe we should think on how to take the best parts of the system and to make it better after this story. So I would say that we will not live in the same healthcare system as we lived before.
All right, well, thank you for that. I am looking forward to whatever comes next, and I do think it'll be interesting for sure. And things will not go back to the way that they were before. So hopefully with the work that you guys are doing and a lot of the other people who are working on these type of issues, we're going to be in a much better place in the future. Let me turn it over to Imre to see what he has to say.
Yeah, and thank you for all these excellent responses. Just to synthesize, I think my personal biggest fear is that somewhat we are going to go back to normal. And I'll just to expand on why I think that would not be the best thing. It's because what I feel like the biggest issue is in terms of how we sense risk and how we understand what's going on right now, is that if I'm an individual and I'm facing COVID and I hear about it in the news, I always think about my own risk somewhere here on the personal level. If I'm a public health professional, I always look from above, from a bird's eye point of view, and I'm looking at what this whole COVID pandemic could cause on a system level, how it can overburden healthcare systems, how it can lead to shortage of supplies. And right now, COVID-19 has a very specific constellation where these two sort of risks are very far away from each other. If I'm an individual and if I look at the risk, I might say it's an 0.51% risk that if I get infected, I might end up in the hospital and then I might die. Everyone can decide for themselves, but a lot of people say, I'm going to take that risk. That is a risk that I'm happy to take, and I also know that it's overwhelmingly the elderly who are affected. Now, what we don't take into factor when we make that equation is that the hospitalization rate, which is very different from the mortality rate, is really high of this virus. So there's almost a 1 in 5 chance that if I get infected, I get to the hospital, which means that this will very quickly lead to an overwhelming of healthcare systems, and that is the real issue. The real issue is not an individual level risk. The real issue here is a population level, a system level risk. And what I'm really, really hoping is that at the end of this pandemic, we will learn to think about our actions and how our actions impact the whole system. And if we are able, on an individual level, to learn this new type of sensation of risk, then this will be applicable to the next flu pandemic, to the next flu outbreak. This will be applicable to how we treat climate change and all sorts of population level issues, which we're struggling with right now. So I'm really hoping that we're not going back to the normal, and that the end of the story is not going to be that COVID. It's going to be just a new, just another infectious disease that has an X amount of deaths each year. I don't want to get used to that thought, and I would prefer that we don't get used to that thought that COVID is here to stay, and we just have to deal with it just like with the other infectious diseases. So that is my take. So I will like to ask everyone to, at the end of this whole pandemic, just think about how our individual actions actually impact the whole healthcare system.
I think that's some really, really sound advice. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to ask Benjamin to have his take on this.
I don't know if I have anything to add to that. I think that was all really wise things to say. I mean, as a scientist, I'm deep into the weeds of how the virus causes disease. So anything I would give to the community, I mean, these people know way better than I do, and I pick up things from the news in this department. I wasn't encouraged by a study that came out just a couple of days ago that followed 2,500 transmission events in China and found that only 2 of 2,500 occurred outside. That's not to go against this idea. I mean, obviously social distancing and all these things are important, but as someone in New York City who I'm watching all the people around me go a little stir crazy locked in their apartments, I would add that, like, it's not terrible to go outside, like, just keep your 6 feet distance, but like, you should also be aware of your own mental health and try and get out a little bit and just do it in a safe and responsible manner.
Yeah, that's actually where we were going to take the last sort of round of questions before we turn this over for Q&A. And Serena, I wanted to start with you. That question is really, do you have advice for the folks who are listening in on how to keep happy and healthy during the current situation? And also, is there anything that really gives you hope? I think I'd like to sort of end on an uplifting note.
So I think, I know, I love this question because I feel like as Fulbrighters, we draw from these general principles that should kind of drive our daily living. And I think that staying connected and learning from other people and other communities and also being tenacious of learning and asking questions. So even while you're social distancing and staying home, you can still stay connected virtually, send random messages to friends you've been wanting to connect with. I just sent my new niece a happy six-month birthday outfit. Like, just doing these random things to stay connected with family and friends, I think, is really a way to stay positive and stay connected, because it's obviously really hard to miss birthdays and important, and, like, you know, weddings or all this stuff. Like, we're missing out on a lot of big life moments, so communicating virtually and trying to stay engaged with the people you love is really, really important. And then I do want to touch on, like, I think for me, this has actually been a good time to reflect on what questions that have been sparked. So answering questions about how can our healthcare system be designed more efficiently, or I'm working on a project with a good friend, Jen Bai, I think she's listening in, on we're using our MBA insights to think about organizational design, from a management perspective. So keep asking questions and reading, and hopefully we'll soon have more answers by that curiosity fueling more solutions soon.
Well, that's great. Who wants to be the next person who sheds a ray of hope on this? Charlotte, is that a smile? Javier, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in. Yeah, I want to take this turn because I want to take a couple of things from Benjamin and from Serena, what they say. Like, this time is kind of like challenging for everybody. And what Benjamin was saying about we need to actually evaluate all the things that we did before and what we are doing now. And we know, for example, that in seasonal diseases, and like seasonal viruses, like staying indoors could be against you because it like kind of like increase the possibility to actually get contagious with some other pathogen or whatever. So maybe going outside is not bad. And actually, I'm hoping, and really hoping that now that we are getting like a warmer weather, people is going to get out, is going to change their behavior, all their activities. That's going to be a boost for all our immune system and also for our mental health. And I think that that's something that is really good. And something that is making me like filling me hope in this moment is what Serena was saying about like these new ways that we have now to connect. So probably a year ago, many people was like complaining about all the effect that social networking and all these like apps has in like distancing people. But now during this pandemic, during this current situation, we are actually taking advantage of those tools that before were distancing us, now they are making us get closer. And I feel that this is a huge opportunity to actually get close to people that you probably won't ever reach if you were in like a normal situation. So that's making me feel like that we are actually building some kind of like a tissue in between us, like connection between us. And that's something that hopefully is going to last for the future.
I might pick up on some of that and say that actually I think the connectedness has been tremendous. So today I should have been arriving in Philadelphia to speak at the American Thoracic Society annual congress that was due to be happening there, but instead I'm using the internet to speak to all of you. And at the same time, one of my very good friends who's based at UMichigan is giving a webinar to a load of British intensive care physicians from his living room, I would imagine, although I'm not watching it at the moment. And so actually the world has got a little bit smaller, even despite social distancing. And we've learned to do things that we would have said were completely impossible by sweeping away the way in which we've always done them, because we haven't had time to do them now. And so if we can capture the really good things about the innovations and the changes that we made, and not just default as in we think we might to how we did things before, actually I'm really hopeful for the future. Some of the lessons we've learned will make climate change a little bit better. The holes in the ozone layer are improving currently because we're all driving our cars a bit less and burning a little bit less in terms of greenhouse gases. Some really positive things could come out of this, as well as some of the really distressing things that have happened. So I'm hopeful about the future, definitely.
Things like that make me hopeful about the future as well. Igor, were you going to jump in?
Yeah, I would like to jump in, and I totally agree with that. It's not only bad times, you can always find something good. And from experience of some of my colleagues, I would say that it's not a bad time to establish serious goals for yourself. You can do something new, you can learn a language. At least one of my colleagues, he started and he learned how to say thank you in 100 languages. So maybe, I don't know how it will help him in his life. From the other hand, I remember right now, Isaac Newton, during the pandemic, it was a plague pandemic, it was the time when he developed the gravity theory. So he used this time in a good way. He used this time to do good things. So I would say that try to find something new for yourself. Write a poem, write an essay, learn something new, learn a new instrument, go for something, go for a large goal, and it will help you to maintain during these hard times.
Yeah, some really good advice right there. I'm happy to hear that as well. Do either of the other two want to jump on and with a positive note, or are you just going to be negative? I'm joking.
I think I can. Yeah, I think I can speak to this a little bit, and I agree with everything that has been said before. Just as a slight reminder, I think those of us who were able to keep our jobs and those of us who have a roof under our heads, I think I just want to remind everyone that we're super privileged to be this lucky, And I think that yes, for a lot of us, this is a time for introspection. This is a time to look at how we deal with work, life balance, and how do we deal with these issues when everything happens in the same space, when we're just home. And it's a good time to craft some positives out of there. But at the same time, I would encourage everyone to look at those who are not so lucky and identify those people in our environments who are struggling because they lost their jobs, who are struggling because this pandemic did not bring that introspection time for them, but brought many, many negative events, and try to see what we can all do to support those who are not as lucky as some of us.
Yeah, good. Benjamin, do you have anything to add?
No, I feel everything was said that needs to be said.
Well, thank you. I completely agree that, there's a couple of different strains from this that I thought would be interesting to pull out very quickly. You know, there are a lot of people right now who are expressing their gratitude to everybody who's working in all of these jobs, both in the medical and public health profession, and also the people who are delivering groceries and taking away trash and things like that. And I think it's a really great opportunity for us, to be grateful. So saying I thank you in 100 languages, it's great to learn how to do that. And I hope that people are doing that to all the people who are making a real difference in our lives today. So with that sort of last bit of gratitude, I wanted to thank Kate for coming in now and offering some questions from some of our viewers. I want to thank you guys for a really great discussion. So let's move this over to the Q&A. Kate, do you have some questions?
Yes, thanks, Vincent. We have a lot of really great questions coming in. And the first one is about the vaccine. As of right now, are there any companies or organizations that are close to achieving a vaccine or drug that will prevent or cure COVID-19? And more generally, how optimistic are you about the recent progress towards achieving a potential vaccine? And why don't we send this question to Benjamin first?
Yeah, no, I think you should be really optimistic about vaccine development. There's a great one that comes out of England that's they use something called an adenovirus, so it's a kind of a very harmless virus to introduce a piece of SARS-CoV-2 in a very safe manner. It's a platform that's been used for a lot of gene therapy trials. We know a lot about it. We know it's safe, and we know it works really well in the small cohort of people that have been tested, and they are now in phase 1 or phase 1-2 clinical trials. There's another one that was published out of China that's in Science magazine. That they also built a pretty standard platform vaccine regimen that they tried in non-human primates, and they found them to be 100% effective. So really, it's just a race to just make sure that, the data out there largely suggests that the vaccines are all perfectly safe, that the antibodies that generated are exactly what they need to be as far as preventing infection and contagion and transmission. And so we just need to make sure they're safe before we start distributing all over the world, of course. And so I'm very optimistic. It's just a matter of how quickly we can show safety. And I feel like it'll probably happen this year.
Excellent. Javier, do you have any other? Oh.
I was just going
to go to Charlotte first and then Javier.
The Oxford vaccine from the University of Oxford, that I think is the one that Ben is talking about, is absolutely in human clinical trials. They're planning on giving it to 16,000 people across the world by the end of June, and that's well on track. It's gone through phase 1 and it's now in phase 2, and it's looking really promising.
Okay, yeah, well, I completely agree with what you said, that Benjamin said about we have to be really happy that things are working well. Things are looking good. The only fact here is that we have to wait. We just need to wait until we pass all these clinical trials with these vaccines. But there is like high expectations that that's going to work. And I also have a lot of hope in some of the compounds that are being tested, some of the drugs that are already passing the phase 3 trials. Some of those antivirals has a good potential to be an option to treat patients while we get the vaccine. So I actually think that we are in a really good position now. And if you compare what is happening now with what happened 20 years ago, we are actually like doing like a lot of like progress every single day. And we are actually really close to get a vaccine that probably could be available for people in less than 2 years, in less than a year and a half maybe. That's something that is actually like amazing. That's something that we have never seen before. So we are in a really good position now, and I think we are like going in the right way.
Great. If we don't have any other comments, I'll move on to the next question. So as of right now, there's a lot of, you know, talk about contact tracing. Can you speak to the efficacy of contact tracing and then also ways that we can deal with data privacy related challenges when we think about tech solutions like contact tracing? And I'll just open that up to anyone that would like to respond.
I guess somebody has to answer. This is out of my wheelhouse. This is a question for epidemiologists, which is why we're all a little nervous to answer, I'm sure. But I mean, contact tracing is incredibly important. It requires a lot of people to accomplish. So I was reading this in the New York Times. So again, this is just coming at it as a layman here. But for New York City, they were saying that it requires 30,000 people to do proper contact tracing. That's because it's not just about testing everybody, which of course is the bare minimum you have to do, but then you have to determine who's contacted who and who is possibly at risk and go and test all of those people. And it just takes an incredibly amount of resources and people to do that, which can be very difficult to coordinate. I do think it's a fantastic idea, but I don't entirely know how practical it is everywhere. So I would love to see it implemented everywhere, but I can also understand why maybe it's not possible everywhere. With regards to like safety of data, I can't really speak to that. I can see the concerns there. I'd like to think more of humanity. Maybe I shouldn't, but I guess I can't really speak to that one.
Yeah, I would like to continue with Benjamin. So I really believe that the efficacy of contact tracing depends on the volume, on the amount of the epidemiologist system. So as long as some country have large epidemiology system, large number of doctors, doctor's assistants, etc., epidemiologists in the system, it will work. There are some systems, mostly in post-Soviet countries, that have this large epidemiology system. In other ways, I believe it won't be that effective. From the other point of view, from the point of view of safety of data and ethical issues, I would say that it's a forever time ethical issue. What is more important, the privacy of individual or the safety of the population? In a number of countries, the safety of the population is much more important, and you can see how the contacts being traced very, very strictly. In some countries, the privacy of individual data is still holding the position. So I believe it's a very, very individual thing depending on the system of the healthcare in the country.
Thank you. This next question is for Imre. How should people deal with instructions coming from different health authorities that are so different from each other? For example, information coming from the Swedish government is very different from the CDC. How can people sort of decide which sources are most, most credible?
It's a very, very pertinent question and really, really hard to answer. Obviously, there is some geographical specificity in terms of what kind of information people can access. There's always information from the WHO, which sets baseline guidelines in terms of what to do at a particular situation. And then countries' own specific health authorities will translate that. And eventually, we will end on some sort of policy that tells people what to do and how to act best. This is a situation where data is continuously just mounting, and there are a lot of questions that we still are not able to answer around this virus and 100% how it spreads. So What I always recommend when we're dealing with these different perspectives is just to try and go a little bit under and see underneath and what's the underlying science behind all those recommendations and what is the bottom line. And I'm always on a little bit on the stricter side with my immediate environment and with my professional environment. So even before social distancing and wearing masks was recommended by health authorities, I was encouraging everyone to do that even right away in early March, because that seems to be the lowest common denominator around all the scientific thinking and all the health authority communications. So I think going one level stricter as what seems to be generally accepted is always a safe bet. With that said, generally this will always be a local decision, and as partially as Dr. Stoma talked about it, it's also a little bit of around value choices, which are outside of my expertise and also the outside of the healthcare expertise. Because on one hand, there's always safety and what that safety means in medical terms and in public health terms. On the other hand, there are other issues like human rights, right to freedom, people's own individual freedom and the sense of freedom and what they understand by that. And these are conflicting right now. And how to decide how to strike the best balance is going to be a challenge that we'll just have to live through, and we'll have to modify our decision and authority's decision based on the evidence that is continuously live flowing in the system.
Thank you. Okay, so our next question is for Serena and Charlotte to answer. And I think it'll be really interesting, both of you working in healthcare, but in two very different systems. The U.S. and U.K. healthcare systems are very different. But what do you think about how the coronavirus will change the conversation in the United States around healthcare? And what can the United States learn from other healthcare systems around the world as a result of the crisis?
Shall I start? Okay, so I'll go first. So I think something that the pandemic has really shifted in our hospital is obviously we were having goals of care conversations with all patients before, but I think it's really had us have these dynamic and productive conversations with families and patients along the entire care trajectory of a patient, because we've had to increasingly communicate with them virtually and over video conference. So it's kind of put that at the forefront. We've also relied heavily on our support from our palliative care colleagues, and I think there's been discussion of even staffing more a palliative care doctor designated specifically for the critical care units in our hospitals, because end-of-life discussions are so important in those settings. So I think that's definitely shifted. And I think when we talk about what can we learn from other healthcare systems, I think that's really interesting. I mean, for what I've learned from my research is that we drive so much of our revenue from elective procedures, and I think that just thinking about how we allocate resources to ensure that all patients get access to basic primary care, which should, in my opinion, should be accessible to everyone, should kind of supersede these questions about how to generate the most revenue. And of course, obviously, healthcare systems can only help people if they're able to sustain some aspect of profitability, but kind of staying that committed to that mission of ensuring that people have basic access to care and are able to stay healthy in the outpatient setting definitely drives our outcomes in the inpatient setting.
I guess it's no surprise that I come from a healthcare system that's not profit-making. We have a universal healthcare system that's free at the point of access to anybody who needs it. And I think if there's ever a time that highlights the importance of that, a global pandemic might just be it, because it doesn't matter whether you can afford healthcare in the UK at the moment. If you need ICU care or you need long-term care and you need the rehab that goes with that, that's what you can access. I think one of the other things perhaps that the United States could learn, certainly in the ICU field, and it's a really small thing here, is it's not common practice across the entire United States for there to be ICU follow-up services and rehabilitation services that go out beyond your ICU stay and into the community for a long period of time, whereas that's been normal practice and actually a standard of care demanded of National Health Service hospitals and ICUs for some years. Every single ICU in the UK offers all of their patients the chance to come back at 3 months, 6 months, and longer term afterwards to deal with the post-ICU follow-up issues. And so I think that's maybe a really quick win, and I know that there's a lot of people in the United States at the moment working on exactly these kind of pathways to try and develop them, because it is something that will make a massive difference to the huge number of patients who've been unwell at the moment.
Great, thanks so much. Well, we have lots of questions, but unfortunately we're not going to be able to get to all of them. So in the interest of time, I'm going to hand it back over to Vincent, and he is going to give some final comments to wrap up our session today. Thanks, everybody.
Well, thank you, Kate, and thanks to the panelists. This was a fantastic panel. I'm really sort of disappointed to bring this to a close, but I do know that everybody has to go back to their normal lives, so we won't take any more of your time. I wanted to thank the wonderful panelists who've taken time out of their busy schedules, and you guys are doing such truly incredibly important work to share your time and your insight with us. We really appreciate it. I'd also like to thank my team at the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs and the Fulbright Program, the outreach team specifically, who worked really hard on making this possible, and all my colleagues at the Bureau who are working day and night to make sure that Fulbrighters who are affected by the pandemic are safe and secure and being taken care of. And I'd like to thank the team at IIE who's put this on. IIE is the reason why we're on this platform and that everything seems to work, and you know, they came up with this good idea, so I'd like to thank them as well. This is the first of a series of Impact in the Field panel highlighting Fulbrighters. The next one is going to focus on the innovations the Fulbright alumni are making as the result of the pandemic in education. The panel is titled Education in the Digital Age, and it's going to bring together experts on education and digital literacy to talk about their work and how to maximize digital spaces for learning. So we hope that you guys can join us on Thursday, May 28th at 9 a.m. Eastern. I'm sure this will be publicized on our social media platforms. So please do check in. You know, friend us, like us, give us a thumbs up, do all those things that you're supposed to do to make us truly feel connected. Again, I wanted to thank all the panelists and to Kate for the great work that she's done today, and thank everyone for joining us. We hope that you guys are leaving inspired by some of these amazing alumni stories, and we wish you all the best and good health as we move forward through this unprecedented time together. So thank you very much for joining us. Have a great day.
Thank you, Vincent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.